I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Why was a blood-red carpet put in the Oval Office right before JFK's assassination? Did Abraham Lincoln ever sleep in the Lincoln bedroom? And what really happened in the Situation Room on 9/11? Today we'll ask Paul Brandis, author and one of the most influential members of the White House Press Corps, to give us a virtual tour of the building's past and present. Then, Midwesterners aren't strangers to extreme swings between drought and flood, and climate change means things are only getting worse. New research suggests this weather whiplash could be affecting our water. I'll ask two KU scientists why and how. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Author and journalist Paul Brandis points out that while we Americans like to think of our country as young, the White House stands as one of the oldest continuous residences for a head of state anywhere in the world. That's even more so than Buckingham Palace. Paul Brandis tells the story of the White House and some of its rooms in his book, Under This Roof, The White House and the Presidency. Paul Brandis is a member of the White House Press Corps, and he's the founder of West Wing Reports. He's also a contributing columnist for USA Today, CNN, and Market Watch. And Paul, nice to have you. Good morning.
How are you? Thank you very much.
Well, you talk in here about the sense of history that hits you and maybe lots of other reporters every time you walk into the White House. Tell us about that feeling.
Well, it's really something. I've been going there, Steve, now for close to a decade. I'm on my third president now, and it really never fails to amaze that when you go through the Northwest Gate, you show your ID and punch in a sort of like an ATM code to go in. And once you are on the complex, boy, you are looking up at that big white building, and it's just amazing. You think, boy, this is where Thomas Jefferson walked, and Abraham Lincoln wrote his Gettysburg address and his Emancipation Proclamation, all of these things. It's just amazing, all the history, the war, the ups and downs. I mean, sort of the war and peace, sex and scandal, just the normal things that presidents do on a daily basis. It's just incredible, and it never gets old. That's the amazing thing.
You know, you point out, Paul, that when John Adams moved in, it was known as the Executive Mansion or the President's Palace.
Right.
When did it become known as the White House?
It did. Well, people called it kind of colloquially the White House for most of that time, but it officially did not become the White House until Theodore Roosevelt. He kind of overhauled the White House, expanded it after he became president in 1901, and he built the West Wing. The Roosevelt family was quite large, and he simply needed more room, so he moved kind of the working presidency out of the mansion to the West Wing, just sort of next door. And he officially changed it, I think, in October 1901, and it's been called that ever since. So many, many names, but for the past 12 decades or so, the White House.
You know, we see the White House for what it is today, Paul, but back in those days when John Adams, you know, first moved in, this was not a comfortable place. How so?
Well, it certainly didn't have the creature comforts that you and I take for granted now, of course. There was no, one of the big ones, of course, was there was no indoor plumbing in Adams' age. And if you can imagine this, the president of the United States had to go out of the mansion, say, in the middle of the night to do his business, if you will, in an outhouse and then come back inside. Boy, imagine that. It wasn't until his successor, Thomas Jefferson, who was a much more fastidious, he sort of installed these kind of a water basins on the top of the mansion, which ran down into the first two, what they called water closets, of course, toilets. Those were the first kind of indoor plumbing that they had. And ever since then, of course, improvements have come over time. But one of the points I make in the book, Steve, is that these improvements generally sort of mirror the expansion and the sort of the adoption of technology that the rest of us have had as well, electricity and telephones and things like that.
Also, the house smelled like beer when John Adams moved in. Why beer?
Well, the workmen who were building the sort of the interior plaster walls, it was just sort of what it smelled like when they mixed all the plaster and sometimes straw and other materials and such. That is what Adams and others thought it smelled like when they went in. So if you can sort of imagine that, it was really kind of an assault on the senses. And I mentioned before the lack of indoor plumbing. There was also, for example, there's obviously no central heating, but there were fireplaces everywhere. And during the wintertime, Washington winters can be kind of tough. So it was not uncommon for visitors to try and stand close to the fireplace and warm up. But if they moved 5-10 feet away, they would freeze. So they would go back and forth and back and forth against these fireplaces during events and so forth.
You know, I love this description of Adams in the house that you write in this book, Paul. I'm going to quote here. He ate supper and then, holding a single candle, climbed the winding staircase intended for servants to his bedchamber on the top floor. As his footsteps echoed across the dim, damp halls, Adams found his new house to be very much like the nation he led. Quite unfinished, but brimming with potential. Fireplaces continued to hiss and spit, fed throughout the night by a watchman. I mean, lonely, but still magnificent nonetheless.
Well, it really was. And when you visit the White House now, you can walk around and see much of what Adams did. The floor plan has changed over the two centuries, but in many respects, it's pretty much the same place. In the East Room, for example, which then as now is the biggest room in the White House. That, of course, is where Abigail Adams famously hung her wet laundry, which I'm pretty sure they don't do, which they don't do today. And but it pretty much is the same. I mean, there have been various renovations and rebuildings and so forth. But if you look at the floor plan then and the floor plan now, I don't think that Adams would have trouble finding his way around if he were to be there today.
She hung her wet laundry in the White House because,
well, there was no, obviously, no
dryers in those days.
No dryers back then, no electricity. I suppose during the summertime, they might have hung them out to dry in the backyard. But that's what she did in the East Room, which kind of showed the East Room for what it is. It's really just, again, then as now, sort of an all-purpose room. Of course, we don't use it for things like that today. It's for, we go there for news conferences and right, cultural events and sometimes state dinners and that kind of thing. No laundry these days, but it's used for many other things.
That she hung her laundry there, was that the subject of gossip around Washington back in those days? I mean, it was a very small town. It wasn't what it is today, but did people talk about that or not really?
Well, Washington then was a town of about 15,000 people, so I'm sure that and people like to gossip then as they do now, of course. So I'm sure that anything that the president and the first lady did.
No, John Adams wrote a letter to Abigail on November 2nd of 1800, and this happened all day in the White House. And a line in that letter resonated so much with FDR many years later that it became part of the House. That line was this, and John Adams wrote it: "I pray to heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." And I'm wondering where those words are today.
Well, they sort of disappeared for about 13 decades. He wrote that in a letter to Abigail, as you say, and then they kind of just vanished into the dusty pages of history. And then in the 1930s, after Franklin Roosevelt became president, he stumbled across those words and was so taken by them that he ordered them carved into the mantle above the fireplace in what is today the state dining room on the main floor. Take the White House tour. It's tough to get in, but if you take the tour, you get to go into the state dining room. You can see those words carved there now, again, above the on the mantle above the fireplace. Very striking. And every time I go in there, I always sort of run my words, and very powerful thing that he said.
Paul Brandis is my guest. He's a journalist and author. His book, Under This Roof, The White House and the Presidency. And I should point out that he'll be speaking in town in the next few days. And I'm just looking for my notes here. At 6:30 Thursday, the Truman Library Institute presents Under This Roof, Stories from a White House Insider at Unity Temple on the Plaza. He'll be speaking on Friday at noon out at the Eisenhower Presidential Library in Abilene. You can get more information on websites for both those institutions. And I'll put out the information again a little bit later. Let's move on ahead to other tidbits about this house, Paul, because here's one. Abraham Lincoln never slept in the Lincoln bedroom or even in the Lincoln bed, which his wife purchased especially to accommodate his 6-foot-4-inch frame. Why not? Why didn't he sleep there?
Well, that's one of the big misunderstandings that people always have about the Lincoln bedroom. Lincoln never slept in the Lincoln bedroom in his day. What room was actually his office on the second floor of the White House. He called it the shop. And it was in that one room that Lincoln really spent the bulk of his presidency. He battered, beat up a desk there, and he met with his aides, and he held cabinet. He drafted the Emancipation Proclamation there, as I mentioned, and so forth. He could even look out the windows across the South Lawn, across the Mall, over the Potomac River into Northern Virginia. And depending on how the Civil War was going, he could sometimes see the twinkling campfires of the Confederate Army just across the river. The enemy was that close sometimes during the war. So that was what Lincoln saw from that particular room. It was his office. Now, so the question is then, well, if Lincoln didn't sleep in the Lincoln bedroom, well, where did he sleep? And he slept actually where most presidents, including President Trump, now sleep. That is actually down the hall in the sort of the northeast corner of the second floor. That then, as now, sort of the master quarters for the president and the first lady. So that is where Lincoln slept. So he would, you know, work these long hours in his office and then sort of walk down. He had a couple of private rooms, not very often, but just not very many, rather, but he had a few private rooms, and he would go from his office to what is today the yellow oval room, which the Lincolns used as kind of a sort of a living room or salon, and that then connected to the bedroom. So he never slept in that room. And the Lincoln bedroom, in fact, since you mentioned Harry Truman, when the Trumans had the White House rebuilt between 1948 and 52, as a tribute to Abraham Lincoln, the Trumans created the Lincoln bedroom. So it didn't really exist until about 80, 90 years after the Lincoln administration had passed, of course.
When Woodrow Wilson was president, he suffered a stroke and was kept hidden on the second floor there. Why was he hidden?
Well, he could not speak. The stroke, first of all, nearly killed him. He could not speak for a long time. He was paralyzed. He could barely move. It nearly killed him. And his wife, Edith Wilson, his personal doctor, Carrie Grayson, a few other White House aides, they did not know what to do. So they decided simply to cover it up. They told people that the president was just resting and, he was functioning as president and everything. He really wasn't. And behind the scenes, Edith Wilson and some of these aides would sort of make decisions on his behalf, sometimes sign papers and so forth. It was, I think, the biggest cover-up in American history. Can you imagine something like that happening today?
No.
Even the vice president didn't really know that much about it. It was really a huge scandal in the sense that they kept it hidden from the American people. And this was really for the last year and a half of the Wilson presidency. This wasn't something, you know, a couple of days where he was ill and they kind of covered it up. It was the last year and a half of his presidency. Absolutely remarkable. So in essence, some historians, Steve, think that she was sort of the acting president. Now, Wilson eventually got a little bit better, could talk a little bit and move and so forth. But he was never the same after that stroke, a huge cover up.
You know, I like to read about presidential history, American history, and I was really bowled over by your chapter on Warren Harding and the dramatic contrast there to the Woodrow Wilson years. I didn't know just how crazy things got during his years in office. I mean, he truly was our playboy president, right?
Oh, he really was. He was kind of the equivalent of sort of like a movie matinee star. I mean, women just swooned over Warren Harding. And one reason why he was elected by a huge landslide in 1920. At the time, it was the biggest landslide ever. And it's only been eclipsed, in fact, by FDR in 36 and Nixon at 72. And for it was a huge win for him. And one reason for that was in 1920, women got the right to vote for the first time. And they loved Warren Harding. They voted for him in droves. And guess what? He loved them back, if you know what I mean. I mean, he was not exactly a monogamous president. He had all kinds of girlfriends and mistresses and so forth. Huge scandals during the short-lived Harding presidency, and the women was just that was just a part of it.
Well, and there's one scene you have in the book about a time when Warren Harding's wife found out that something suitable for their marriage was occurring in the Oval Office, and she made a beeline for the Oval Office, stopped by a Secret Service agent who was sympathetic to the president. I mean, can you imagine? I was grasping for words there, Paul.
Harding's wife knew for years, of course, that he was a big time. She sort of put up with it. It aggravated her. But that one particular story is that he, in fact, was fooling around with one of his girlfriends. Mrs. Harding found out about it, came running down, and was blocked again by a Secret Service agent. Warren Harding was just incredibly reckless with his personal life. I mean, everybody now knows about John F. Kennedy. Warren Harding was equally as reckless. He often had, here's one story about Harding that people know, aside from saying, you know, illegitimate child he fathered with one mistress. He had another mistress who went, listen to this, when he was had a sexual romp with her in Central Park in broad daylight. If you can, again, we're talking about things that sort of, can you imagine anything like that sort of happening in the United States here? I mean, he just did things that were just mind-boggling. Warren Harding.
Let's scoot on down the road here to FDR, because you also point out that FDR make them sound so conversational and to connect with the American people at this pivotal time in American history. I didn't realize that he practiced so much because, you know, he was such a confident man that you know, he just figured it came naturally to him to go out there and do what he did.
Well, practice makes perfect.
Right.
And he worked for hours and hours at, people don't know, such an interesting, I'm glad you brought that, it's such an interesting topic. In the 12, about 30 of these fireside chats.
And that was intentional. That was very intentional on his part.
Absolutely, because he thought that he had sort of a less is more philosophy, and if he was on all the time, that it would lose the impact and the drama. So he deliberately went on a very few times, again, four or five times a year. And that was, I'm sorry, about three or four times a year. And that was it. And when he prepared these talks, he would spend days working the language and practicing out loud and timing them and so forth. And aides often said, well, aren't you spending too much time preparing these, Mr. President? And he said, to the contrary, no. This is the most important thing that I can possibly do. And he was right. And just to show you how effective he was with these fireside chats to subsequent presidents who are also regarded, I think, as pretty masterful communicators in their own era, John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan, each said that they were influenced heavily by FDR. One of the first things, in fact, that John F. Kennedy asked when he came to the White House in 1961, he said, how many of these fireside chats did Roosevelt give? And when JFK found out that that Roosevelt actually gave very few, it validated Kennedy's view that he too should limit his appearances on television. Kennedy actually he could have gone on TV anytime he wanted, of course, but he frequently turned down chances to be on TV. Kennedy thought that that if he went on TV all the time, he would become a bore to the American people. So he had also, like FDR, kind of a less is more philosophy. Ronald Reagan, in the meantime, grew up a Democrat. He idolized Franklin Roosevelt, sort of copied his style with his own radio addresses and so forth. Both of them gave full credit to Franklin Roosevelt for their own style, particularly the less is more philosophy, which I think is a lesson in restraint that maybe future presidents perhaps did not heed. I think Donald Trump, for example,
you're taking the words out of my mouth there. You know, President Trump might take a lesson there.
Well, I'm not making a political comment about Donald Trump, but in terms of the less is more, I think that he's on television too much, and we also have this 24/7 culture now. And I think people we get tired of our presidents after 4 years or eight mm-hmm. years. So I think he runs the risk. And again, I'm not making a political observation about whether I like him or not. I'm simply saying that maybe being on television a little bit less might not be such a bad thing for him.
Well, speaking of President Trump, you know, the press obviously is under siege like never before in the course of the Trump presidency here. What's it been like for you to cover this president in the wake of the Obama years? What's different? How are you navigating this, Paul?
Well, all presidents are different. And for people who think that things are really bad now, I'll point out that actually during the Obama era, they were actually quite secretive, too. They were very careful about who they spoke with. They were very tightly controlled in terms of information and documents gave forth. They were very secretive. Donald Trump, on the other hand, say what you will about him, but he talks to a lot of reporters. Now, whether what he's saying is honest or not, that's another subject, but he talks to everybody. He answers questions. He doesn't shy away to engage with people. Now, he has this press office that I think is having a very difficult time, because I think even Trump supporters know that, you know, he's not Mother Teresa here. He's told a whopper from time to time. Let's just put it that way. Again, even his supporters, I think, can acknowledge that. And it's difficult then for his press folks, Sean Spicer, to come out. And when Trump says something that people just is easily checkable on Google or something, you know that's not true. Spicer is always asked, well, how come he would say something like that that's just obviously not true? And that's a tough, he works for the president, and yet he's trying to give us information too. Boy, it's really a Night Live thing the other night. Yeah. Boy, he just got to skewered. So he's in a really tough job in the best of circumstances. These press secretaries, they last 2 years, 3 years, press secretaries. So I think that, you know, Trump is going to have some turnover as well. So
Paul Brandis is the founder of West Wing Reports, the news service. His book, Under This Roof, The White House. Again, you can see and hear him 6:30 Thursday evening. The Truman Library Institute presents Under at Unity Temple on the Plaza. You can also see him on Friday at noon in Abilene at the Eisenhower.
Well, the pleasure is mine, Steve. Thank you so much.
Time for a break here. When we come back, we'll talk about weather whiplash here in the Midwest and how it might affect you. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. We are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, there's that old saying about weather in this part of the country that if you don't like it now, just wait 5 minutes. But new research suggests that weather patterns brought on by global climate change could negatively affect water quality in our part of the country. Joining me now to talk about Carried It Out, they are water quality expert Amy Bergen. She's an associate professor of environmental studies at KU and an associate scientist for the Kansas Biological Survey. And Amy, good morning.
Good morning.
Also here is soil scientist Terry Lucky. He's an assistant professor also at KU, and he's also an associate scientist at the Kansas Biological Survey. Terry, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So first off, this idea of weather whiplash is based on the premise that climate change will affect weather patterns throughout the Midwest. I know you aren't meteorologists or climate scientists, but that's kind of where your research takes off. So what are the specific weather changes that scientists expect to see in the future that concern both of you? Amy?
Sure. So our work is trying to understand how these changing weather patterns, particularly heavy precipitation, extreme rainfall events, and severe droughts, connect to what ends up in the water in terms of water quality. So what we show in our paper is that we expect these switches between drought and flood to be more frequent into the future, and that has implications for declining water quality.
Yikes. Well, walk me through this process now, Terry. How does drought followed by rain, something that is fairly normal in this part of the country, you know, how does that deteriorate water quality? What's the impact there?
Yeah, so drought tends to stop nutrients from entering our water systems. And so
when there's no water to push it in.
There's no water to put. And so there, when we get, so all the nutrients that are still being made available to the plants, either by the crops, either by fertilizer or from natural processes in the soil, as they progress, in the lack of that water to push it along, they accumulate. Or with a flood, it pushes out that at greater concentrations, that make more of that those nutrients coming out.
Huh. Amy, what are the water sources that we're talking about here? I mean, lakes and rivers, drinking water. What about underground aquifers? Help me there.
Sure. Yeah. So there, all of these water systems that you just listed are connected. And however, our work is mostly focused on surface water, in particular surface water in an area we call the Upper Mississippi River Basin, which includes states like Iowa and Illinois, Indiana, that have a lot of agriculture in them. And so we were mostly looking at small streams that run together to become large rivers, and then looking at where a large river, the Iowa River, empties into the Mississippi River. So this is talking at a very big scale.
I was going to say, you're both at KU, but most of your data that you're looking at is coming out of Iowa.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, Iowa has some of the best nutrient monitoring in the nation. Iowa has, I think, close to 60 of these real-time nitrate sensors, which puts it way ahead of most other states. And so the data is available there. That's a big piece of it. Terry and I are also native Iowans, so we like to go back home and kind of think about.
I used to work in Dubuque, but once upon a time, and have great affinity for Iowa, covering the presidential caucuses every few years.
Sure.
So, Terry, these sensors that Amy just referred to, real-time nitrate sensors, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, so we're talking about instruments that are deployed into the stream, into the river, and usually secured with concrete and steel and wood.
So they're anchored there. They're not going anywhere.
They're anchored there, and hopefully they don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
They are expensive to buy up front, but they are relatively cheap to maintain. And so because we can connect them through cellular signals, they can show up on your computer at your desktop anywhere in the world because they're connecting to the internet.
Anybody can log on and see these things?
Yep, you can go on right now and see what's happening in nitrate in rivers around the Midwest.
I'd like to tell you there's going to be a huge rush towards that. Now that's
I haven't given you the address. So.
But maybe not. Yeah, who knows? Yeah.
So even the closest ones here we see in the Kansas River are nearby here in DeSoto. DeSoto, Kansas.
And Iowa is so good at having these sensors. It's a big ag state. Mm-hmm. They're very, conscientious of how much nitrates are being put into the water up there?
So I'm not entirely sure on the motivation, other than wanting to know what's there and who wants to know. in terms of why they are, they know they're a big source of nitrate for local drinking waters and for nitrogen that makes its way into the Gulf of Mexico and causes mm-hmm. damage in the Gulf of Mexico.
You mean fertilizer that's inputted, spread on the ground in Iowa or Minnesota might find its way all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. It takes about, on average, a month for a particle of water that ends up in a river in Iowa to make its way to the Gulf of Mexico. But there's a direct timing relationship between how much nitrogen is leaving Iowa and when we see the problems start to develop in the Gulf of Mexico.
Like what kinds of problems?
So what is commonly referred to as the dead zone, which is an area the size of a small northeastern state. It's usually compared to something like the area the size of Connecticut, where there's no oxygen. And so that means that there's no fish or benthic bottom-dwelling creatures that can live in a big patch of the Gulf of Mexico.
How big a patch?
About the size of Connecticut on average.
About the size of Connecticut.
It's huge.
And I imagine it's getting bigger.
Well, it varies over time, but it's related to how much water and how much nitrogen is coming downstream from these agricultural regions upstream.
And that would suggest, Amy, that certain times of the year when fertilizer is spread might be the times of the year when it shows up a month later down there?
Yeah, certainly. The nitrogen in Midwestern streams tends to peak in May. Right about now, we're seeing highest nitrate concentrations on the annual cycle. And then in about late June and July, the dead zone really starts to heat up in the Gulf of Mexico.
These sensors, you said, Terry, aren't cheap. What do they cost and what do they look like here?
They kind of look like a stainless steel water bottle, about a little bit bigger than the diameter of a softball bat.
These are small things.
Yeah, they're about about a foot in length and about 4 inches. They're stainless steel. Then they're attached by wiring up to up to some batteries to keep the thing powered and then the connection to the internet.
What do they cost?
$15,000 to $20,000 per sensor.
Oh, yeah. Do Kansas and Missouri and Nebraska and Oklahoma, do they have sensors in their surface water facilities too?
Yeah, we did a quick look ahead of time. I think Kansas had 5 mm-hmm. and Missouri has 2 that we could find. So not nearly the density that we have in Iowa. And that's a big piece of why we did the work there as well.
Do we need to have more here?
That's a good question. As a scientist, we always like to see more data and more support for monitoring these kinds of things. So certainly we can't understand the dynamics of the system if we don't have data to look at. That said, you know, the problem is in Iowa in part because the agricultural density is so high and the nitrate concentrations are much higher there.
Mm-hmm.
So
the bottom line here, Terry, is we got a problem.
We got a problem. It's going to get worse with how precipitation is projected to change in the next century.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the problem being what? Articulate it for us one more time here.
That nitrate is leaving mostly agricultural fields, going into our surface waters. Well, surface waters are being used for drinking water in many municipalities, and that drinking water is the nitrate in that drinking water is exceeding the acceptable limit for the drinking water standards.
Because the cleansing process that goes on can't keep up with the levels of nitrate?
Because we don't generally cleanse for nitrate. We don't generally remove it.
Why not?
It's generally below what we call the water quality standard, so it's below the limit, and so it's expensive to remove, and so we don't remove it until it gets below a certain, or until it gets above a certain concentration.
Yikes. Okay, well, maybe our listeners have questions about this, what this might mean for their kids, what this might mean for their households. 816-235-2888 is the phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I'm visiting here with two scientists with the Kansas Biological Survey. They are Amy Bergen and Terry Lucky. What's different about the soil and the terrain in Missouri and Kansas, Amy, compared to what you might see up in Iowa?
That might be a little bit more in Terry's wheelhouse than mine.
Terry, run with it.
So there's the areas that are most productive for agricultural productions have a combination of soils that are young and the precipitation patterns that match that of the temperature, the seasonality. So in Iowa and in Kansas, we have this really nice lot of rain in the middle of the summer and not so much in the winter. And in Iowa, we have really young soils. They were glaciated between 15 to 20,000 years ago, or at certain parts of it, 15, 20,000 years ago. In Kansas, we have many fewer of those. And in Missouri, we have very few of those young soils. Mm-hmm. They're not as old as soils that we see like in the southeast part of the United States, but they're fairly old compared to what we see in Iowa. And those rich soils in Iowa have been a real draw for agricultural producers for a long time. And so you build up some of these nutrients in the soil, and they continue to be released into the water system as this very same mechanism which they go into the crop to make that crop grow is also the same mainly the same mechanisms which dump it into our surface waters, which makes it a difficult problem. We want the crops to grow, but we also don't want some all this nutrients in our water.
Amy Bergen, the danger of having too much nitrate in the surface water then running downstream here is what?
Sure. So immediately it can cause health impacts. So the reason there is a drinking water standard for nitrate is, because it can affect infants in something called blue baby syndrome, where it gets into their bloodstream and affects their ability to absorb oxygen. It's also being linked to certain kinds of cancer. That's still a little bit correlative, but colorectal cancer and urinary tract cancers are connected to high and chronic nitrate exposure. So it affects human health. And as Terry said, it also affects our pocketbooks when people have to pay more to have that high nitrate removed from their drinking water. It can affect.
How high above safe levels are the nitrate levels here in the Kansas City area, Missouri, Kansas? Do you have any sense of that?
Sure. Yeah. So the levels in the Kansas City area are not above the EPA drinking water limit, which is 10 milligrams per liter.
So we're okay here.
Yeah. It's still there. There's nitrate in the surface water, but it's far below acceptable levels. Most of the river data I've seen has it in 1 to 3 milligram per liter. And so the drinking water where you have to start treating it is 10. So we're well below that.
Do you trust that acceptable level standard? Is that something you can bet your life on there?
Well, I don't know the full details of how that standard came to be a nice round number like 10. Certainly, we can't do tests on people, right? That's not ethical to feed some people nitrate and see what happens. But we know that there's some problems when people have exposure. So some level is certainly an unsafe level.
So we're okay here in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. What about more broadly, over to Lawrence, where I gather you guys might live,
sure.
And then Missouri, rural Missouri, what are we seeing there?
So there are certainly areas, we mostly know Kansas. Nitrate is one of the more common drinking water violations. When I looked up the Kansas Department of Health and the Environment report on drinking water, I think I saw for 2016 there were somewhere around 20 cities that had nitrate drinking water violations. They tend to cluster in a couple of areas. One that received some national attention is Pretty Prairie.
I was gonna ask you about that.
So Pretty Prairie is a little bit of a different situation. My impression is that their drinking water source is groundwater, but they've had a consistent problem, I believe, for 20 or more years with high nitrate in their drinking water, and are also trying to find funds to install one of these new water treatment plants, which is very expensive for small towns.
Terry, Susan from Kansas City called to ask us this. What kind of home filters will remove nitrates?
I'm going to let that one on Amy, actually.
So I believe like the standard kind of Brita pitcher filters will remove certain amounts of nitrate.
What did you call them?
Brita, the pitcher filters.
Okay.
The ones that you kind of just plug in and let water trickle through. We've also installed in our homes previously small reverse osmosis systems that you can pick up at Home Depot that run about $200. Those remove a variety of things, nitrate among them.
Reverse osmosis?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
It's a type of water treatment system where you can remove certain kinds of chemicals through a process called reverse osmosis.
So some people, it sounds like, should be thinking about this. Maybe in Kansas City we're okay, but other people might begin to wonder about this.
Certainly if people are in rural areas where they're on groundwater wells, where it's not tested regularly, those kinds certainly need to be thinking about protecting themselves with some kind of a home system.
Okay. Margot from Smithville. Margot, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, thanks. With regard to nitrates and urban runoff pollution, you know, when we get that first flush, what's its relation to these newer erratic rainfall patterns?
We haven't investigated that directly, mostly because the watersheds that we've been studying are very large in scale, and so the urban part of it ends up being a small component. You can get stormwater events in which, especially when you exceed the capacity of the sewage treatment facilities to really increase concentrations of nutrients like nitrate in them during big storm events.
Does that help, Margot?
Yeah, I just, you know, as we move forward, kind of like with the agricultural lands and you know, these things sit on the surface in cities. I know that once upon a time when I was doing watershed work, I found it to be as high as a 50-50 split as to where nitrogen was coming from, because so many people insist on using, you know, these companies to keep their lawns artificially green.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wondered if the weather patterns and, you know, were going to make us run into even further problems along those lines.
I mean, the same basic mechanisms should be there between the urban and the rural in terms of being susceptible to being flushed by floods and being stored by droughts. To the extent to which that occurs, I haven't dug into very deeply on the urban side.
What else needs to happen in rural America to prevent nitrate levels from spiking to dangerous levels here? What's your sense?
Yeah, there's a number of things we can do regarding solutions. The first, I think, is to make sure we understand this is kind of what we think one of the first studies linking this issue of climate change and water quality. So we still have a long way to go in terms of understanding and funding research and monitoring to really understand our local area as well as the U.S. as a whole. In terms of rural areas, there clearly need to be partnerships between urban centers and rural areas because we all share this water as a resource. And what happens within a watershed doesn't stay right at that source, right? That water moves from the agricultural field to a city where it's used for municipality and drinking water sources. And so cities end up cleaning up some of this and paying to clean up a problem that originates in rural areas. So there have to be some solutions that bridge that divide between where the problem occurs and where the end users are.
What does nitrate do for crops? What's the point of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so nitrate becomes turns into proteins that we eat. Basically, makes the leaves green, makes them, you know, able to grow and photosynthesize. Without nitrogen, there is no crops.
Hey, and are you seeing farmers use more of it these days because of the changing weather patterns?
No, we're not. We're not seeing that, at least on a landscape level, and at least the amount of fertilizer that's being put on. And some of it has to do with changes in the market, such as the move to ethanol changes the amount of nitrogen that stays on the landscape. The livestock intensity of the area changes that. And so overall, as a country, we've done better at using less nitrogen per amount of grain that we produce in the last 20 years.
Now, that said, we don't really know how farmers are going to respond to changing weather patterns, whether they'll start to alter how they apply and when they apply and how much. And that's another one of these very big unknowns. If they start to apply more, knowing that there's going to be big spring rains that might wash it away, that could, you know, exacerbate the water quality decline.
So there's a lot of questions there about the socioeconomic responses that, you know, go beyond our physical.
I got 30 seconds left. How is your research being received?
Well, we think.
You sent out a flare here to the rest of the country,
right.
Saying,
yeah.
look out ahead here,
we
folks.
Certainly want to engage more with policymakers because we think it is a problem that you know, we're already seeing pop up a little bit, and we want to see more action and more education on this potential issue.
One more thing to worry about, right?
Mm-hmm, of course.
Yeah, okay. I want to thank our two experts here from the Kansas Biological Survey, Amy Bergen, Terry Lucky. Thank you both for coming in today. Sure appreciate it.
Thanks for the invite.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, the life of a wartime photographer and the hunt for the perfect pitch in baseball. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.